Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to a conversation on the topic of solidarity. I'm Christopher Flood, the drummer Nars.
And I'm Malcolm Burnley.
And this is Pushback. We have a great show lined up for you. Our guests include
Mayor Kenney, the mayor of Philadelphia, and Professor Sally Scholes of Villanova, who's a professor of philosophy.
And Erica Almaron, executive director of Juntos, and Gregory Halston, the executive director of Power. And it's one thing all these guests have in common, and it's solidarity.
Flood, you know me a little bit, right? Would you consider me a pessimistic person or an optimistic person, do you think?
Can I say a tie?
A tie? Oh, man.
I think there are ways in which you're pessimistic. I think there are ways in which you're optimistic. And I think both of them may be appropriate. So,
okay.
But I think everybody is neither all good or all bad. Most people are centrist. Most people exhibit and play in the field of both ends.
Well, I think of myself as a pessimistic person.
Oh, really?
Okay. At least that's what I think I put out in the world. So it's nice to hear your compliments that I'm not always that grumpy. But the reason why I bring that up is that, you know, after the election of our new president, you know, there was a lot of things, of course, a lot of negative energy, a lot of dread, a lot of fear. And I feel like, you know, there was a sense from amongst a lot of people that, you know, the world was ending, right? There was a sense of pure pessimism. But oddly enough, over the last few weeks, despite, you know, his travel ban, despite the, you know, ascension of his cabinet, I've actually felt really optimistic.
No, I think it's a great observation. I think a lot has changed since not just Election Day, particularly Election Day, because I think that's when the most trauma occurred. But a lot has changed since Inauguration Day. But I think the shift came as we approached Inauguration Day. I think you started to see people. Right after the election, people were very sad. People were depressed. People felt hopeless. People felt they didn't know their place in the world. And now you don't see people talking about, I want to leave America and go to Canada. You really see that anymore.
Yeah.
People are like, I want to stay here, right? This is my country,
yeah.
And I'm going to act on it. I think that major shift in attitude is amazing. My concern is, will it last?
Yeah, right. Because that's always the concern with movement versus moment, as we've often been talking
about.
What
are we witnessing, you think? A movement or a moment?
I think I'm optimistic that it is a movement for a few reasons. One is, I feel like there's...
Well, before you even go there, what's the difference, in your opinion, between a movement and a moment?
Well, I guess like a moment is fleeting, right? A moment is energy that is expended and, you know, there's nothing underlying. There's no formation of political groups. There's no formation of, you know, I guess, long-lasting organization. Versus that would be what a movement is. And I think the reason why I think it is turning into something is two reasons. One is, you know, you haven't seen any ebbing of protests, despite the fact that, you know, the progressives have not had any victories recently. Like, you know, every single one of the cabinet picks has been put in place. You know, Trump is doing essentially all the things that were our worst fears. And then the second reason is, you know, over the last several years, there's been a lot of, I feel like, moments, and I feel like it's all been building up to a movement. There was, you know, Occupy on the left, you know, obviously Black Lives Matter is still going on, and a lot of social justice related work. So I feel like there's been a lot of moments, and I think that they are coalescing into.
I would push back on one thing you said. I think that there has been a victory. I think the judge ruling against the travel ban, and I think that was a lot of influence by the protests. I think, you know, that we've seen here at the airport, at Philadelphia International Airport, with the mayor and the governor and the congressman,
mm-hmm.
But all over the country, right? And even so, all over the world. I mean, this is a presidency that has bought out the worst and the best of America. Sure, you have the alt-right, you have the white nationalists, you have the white extremists that are coalescing in this moment, and they feel that they have a victory. But then, as you saw when Trump came to Philadelphia a couple of weeks ago, in some way he is unifying the political left in a way that, if it's harnessed
absolutely,
correctly, it
yeah.
could absolutely be a moment. But I think so far the only victory that they have is putting a stay or halting that immigration ban.
Right, I would say so.
And I think that's a huge victory, right?
Is a huge victory in the short term. I mean, it was such an immediate thing, you know,
yeah.
like that the threat was really visceral at that moment. So, I mean, you know, I guess it was like, you know, one victory and, you know, a lot of defeats in a lot of ways, you know, especially with it.
Do you think that one victory is enough to convince people that this is not a moment, that this can be something that if we stick to it, we can have a lot more moments within them? Because you know what?
Yeah.
There's movement, there's moment, and then there's moments within a movement.
Yeah. Say that three times fast.
There's moments, there's movement, then there's moments within a movement.
I do think. And there was also, Trump has not decided to come. He canceled some stops, and a lot of people think that was because people were threatening protests. Basically, I don't think he's going to be coming back to Philly anytime soon.
Not only is the message going to get to Trump, it's going to cause him to change his actions. I absolutely believe it's going to influence his behavior.
I mean, I'm going to be interested to see and also see what our guests have to say about that. I mean, I'm not sure how optimistic I am that the movement is largely just about stopping Trump. I'm not sure.
I think it started out trying to stop Trump. I think the more people are coming together in their space, the more they're realizing we have an organic chemistry as it relates to our cause. And what brought us into this moment is anti-Trump sentiment. But what's going to keep us is that we actually have a real link that brings us to this moment. And I guess that gives us a natural transition into our next guest or to our first guest,
right,
which is
the mayor of Philadelphia, Jim Kenney.
Well, yeah, I guess.
And who was also, largely rode a wave of progressivism into office, obviously a year before Trump was elected. So it'll be interesting to hear what he has to say.
Yeah, I mean, he is showing, I think, for that office, a level of unprecedented solidarity, right? I mean, you remarked that it was not just him, but seeing him and Helen, City Councilwoman Helen Gibbons, and others at the airport, that was a shifting point for you, right? As a solidarity shifted your perspective on this.
It was. I don't think the mayor showing up necessarily shifted my perspective, but not to poke at him.
Yeah.
But, I think it was just a moment of thousands of people showing up.
Yeah, so I agree. So let's get to our guests. The listeners, you guys are in for a treat. We have the mayor of Philadelphia, and we're talking with a professor from Villanova, right?
Yeah, a philosophy professor named Sally Scholes, who wrote a really, really interesting book in 2008 about political solidarity.
What's the name of the book?
The book is called Political Solidarity.
Oh, is it? Yeah. Oh, okay, cool. Very cool.
So, very upfront about, I guess, what the book is about.
Yeah.
But it's... very much applicable to today. And actually, I was shocked that, I started reading it and that it was written, almost 8 years ago.
Yeah.
Or nine.
And then our final conversation will be with Erica Almaran from Juntos, which is an immigrant advocacy organization here in Philadelphia. And she'll be in conversation with Reverend Gregory Halston, the executive director of Power. And what brings them into this moment of solidarity is a desire to see a Fourth Amendment city, right? So I think that's going to be kind of cool. We're going to be talking to the mayor about solidarity and immigration and sanctuary city, and then talking to people on the other side of that.
Yeah, who aren't. Well, I'll let them speak for themselves. I was going to say who aren't happy with him, but I don't know if that's actually the case.
I think they're happy, but they want to be happier. Is that fair?
Yeah, I want to be happier too, man.
We all want to be happier. All right, let's get to the conversation.
I guess it's Mayor Jim Kenney, Mayor of the City of Philadelphia. Thank you, sir, for being here. Mayor, we want to talk to you about the issue of solidarity, or the topic of solidarity, rather. People watched you at the airport advocating for immigration. And this has kind of followed your trend on advocating around the immigrant population. What's calling you to action in this moment? Is it a personal thing for you?
Well, I mean, first of all, I mean, my ethnic heritage is one of being a refugee or being descendants of refugees from Ireland during the Great Hunger, the 1840s, when Britain was starving the country out. 1 million people died there, and 1 million people emigrated. And when the Irish came here, they were Catholic, but for the most part, and were basically told to go back where they came from, and the Catholics were going to ruin the country, similar to what they're saying about Muslims now. Burned down two churches in Philadelphia, St. Michael's and St. Augustine's, and tried to burn down a third. So, I mean, if you know your history in this country, whether you're African-American who came in chains, or whether you are African and came here because of economic and political strife, or Middle Eastern, or Southeast Asian. I mean, everybody has a story. Mm-hmm. The only people who didn't arrive here are Native Americans, who probably got the biggest shaft of anybody, and still getting it, as you see at Standing Rock. So, I mean, white Europeans have not necessarily been that great. For anybody. We threw out the British in our revolution, but all men were created equal is not exactly accurate. All white men with land were created equal. Women, minorities, and others weren't. I mean, the first person to die in the Revolution was Crispus Attucks, and you very rarely hear about him. I hear more about Ben Franklin.
Are you going above and beyond in this moment of solidarity, or do you see what you're doing as part of your job description?
I don't like bullies. And when you bully people and you marginalize people, it angers me. And I think that we have a responsibility to stand up and call it out and fight it. Fight it in the courts, fight it in the streets. I mean, yeah, it's similar to what, I mean, with Black Lives Matter. I mean, that message needs to be heard and it needs to be spoken, because there are disparities in how people are treated. And it's wrong, and it needs to change. And it's been that way for a long time, and it's not going to change overnight. But you need to make those changes, and you need to listen to people. And you can't just dismiss people's identities. You can't dismiss people's ideals, and you can't dismiss people's grievances. You need to listen to them and try to change them as best you can.
So I'm wondering, the election for a lot of people was a moment where, I guess, in the wake of it, people have been kind of reconsidering beliefs that they held true about the country, or even just like an understanding of what is possible and what's not in politics. And I was wondering, from your perspective, in terms of like political allies, have you been having to, I guess, reconsider or look at whether it's a more centrist Democrat or whether it's, you know, a Democrat on the far, far left? Have you been having to reconsider who is a political ally and who might not be since the election?
I don't think you can govern from the left or the right. I think you have to govern from the middle. I mean, for example, we're doing things in the upcoming budget that we're recommending to continue to expand our pre-K opportunities, to expand folks' opportunities to recover from opioid addiction, to recover from homelessness and to get training and treatment. At the same time, we're reducing taxes. So I think it's not left or right, it's the middle. And I think virtue lies in the middle, as has always been said. Sometimes you have to go a little left because the Trump administration, Harrisburg, are sending stuff to us or threatening to send stuff to us that is unconscionable. I don't understand, frankly, why a state senator from Lackawanna County or from Westmoreland County or Tioga County gives a goddamn about who lives in Philadelphia. I mean, give us all your immigrants.
Right.
I mean, I'll take them all because generally they're law-abiding, generally they work hard, and generally they start businesses and employ people. And that's the way it's been in this country for a long time. Now, on the African-American side, it's a different narrative. It's a different dialogue because of the discrimination. Because I mean, and I was cracking up because people say, you know, slave. I never owned a slave, and slavery is a long time ago. Yeah, but it set in motion a set of circumstances that have impacted people to today. I mean, think about when the Constitution was adopted. If they had said back then, look, within 10 years, all people who are owned by someone else would be free. So, and they allowed it to happen over a 10-year period, as opposed to waiting for the Civil War. What a different distribution of wealth would be in this country. People would own their own land. Their families would not have been disrupted and torn apart. They wouldn't have been sold to other parts of the country. I mean, it's an unconscionable historical sin that this country still lives with. And if we had changed it back then, we wouldn't have these problems.
I'm wondering, you know, over the last, I was going to say over the last few years, but you've only been in the mayor's seat now a little over a year. It's been amazing.
Longer.
Yeah. And you've accomplished a lot, obviously.
The last month seems like 10 years.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Every day.
Bill Maher said 1 month of Trump is like 5 years of Nixon, which is totally accurate.
Well, actually, on that note, I'll ask a different question because I'm actually curious. You're known as someone, you know, who can wear your emotions on your sleeve in a way that it resonates with a lot of people. I think that's one of the reasons why people really identify with you. I mean, how has it been the last month? I mean, have you felt like it's been more of an emotional burden, have you felt emboldened?
No, it's an emotional burden. I will tell you, when I first came into public office in 1992, I was 32 years old. I was much more right-wing than I am now. I was much more, you know, matter of fact, and get people off the street and lock people up. And as time went on, through influences in my career, like Augusta Clark, Marion Tasco, other folk, I learned that things are not as black and white as you would think. I grew up in a white, you know, lower middle class neighborhood, white Irish Catholic neighborhood, and things were the way they were. Things were the way their grandparents said. And you know, the N-word was a word you didn't hear infrequently in my neighborhood. And in 1968, and I was 10 years old, it was Nixon versus Humphrey versus Wallace. Martin Luther King was assassinated. Bobby Kennedy was assassinated. The Tet Offensive started. Kids were coming home in boxes, you know, in flag-draped coffins from Vietnam. And it was a very unsettling, scary time. I feel that way now. I feel like this is 1968 all over again. But in the end, things turned out all right. I mean, it's not perfect.
Right.
Civil rights happened. Voting rights happened. and now they're trying to dial all this stuff back.
Well, if I can just to kind of clarify, I do want to get your understanding of solidarity. How do you define that then and now?
I think,
and then, and I'll make a part of the second question. Then I'll pass it to Malcolm, and then on the second tail of that, how should people, the public, the have their expectation of solidarity from you? Clearly, this immigration piece is something that's personal, and you're stepping out on that. But every cause won't see you do that, right? I mean, what should people's expectation on solidarity be coming from your office?
People's expectation of me is that I'll listen, and I won't judge. I mean, I remember going, and you were there. I remember going to that church, mm-hmm. and when I walked into that church on North Broad Street, I knew it was going to happen. Mm-hmm. I knew going in what was going to happen, but I needed to do it because I needed people to have the opportunity to vent. Mm-hmm. Because that stuff builds up and builds up and builds up. And sure, you'll say, well, some folks are on the far extreme and fringe of that. Some people will never be happy with what you do. Mm-hmm. But you still have to be respectful and listen to them. And that's why I was so proud, despite our difficulties in policing in America, I was so happy that we've made no arrests during the DNC. We've made very few arrests. The only arrests were made in the protests and recently is when people threw stuff at the cops and, you know, threw latex gloves filled with mace. Mm. I mean, those folks got arrested, and they should be. Mm. But the point is that our police have been in those circumstances of civil disobedience, First Amendment expression, have been respectful of it and have not been overbearing. Mm-hmm. And I'm happy about that. And it takes, you know, you have to look at the police side too sometimes. You know, people are screaming in your face, screaming in your face, screaming in your face, and you have to have the restraint not to do anything about it. Unless that person crosses the line and hurts somebody or hurts you, then I think that's a hard job to do.
Get your take on is, so for example, a lot of my younger friends are, you know, kind of politically galvanized now or interested in getting involved. Mm-hmm. But I feel like a lot of their energy is going towards, say, like protesting to me or protesting, right. you know, Trump's nominees. Mm-hmm. And it's not so much getting involved on a local level. And I was wondering if you had any, I don't know, either expectation or what you would hope someone this energy gets channeled into. Like, what do you think would be the best way to get that
I think that people should protest and people should express their First Amendment rights. But I also think they should take their energy and put it into helping homeless, helping people recovering from addiction, helping people who are reentering society from jail, helping kids who are trying to learn in our elementary schools, to take that anger and that motivation and put it into positive use in areas where we need it. Volunteering at rec centers, volunteering with immigrant groups, you know, those kind of things. I think that really makes a difference.
So one thing I was really curious to get your take on is there's been so many protests nationally.
$3 million in overtime in a month.
I was going to say there's probably a protest.
We didn't have a snowstorm, but we have overtime now on protest.
Yeah, and there's one, you know, I know there's one outside city council today, and maybe it wasn't a protest, but there was something out in the courtyard, like there's like a protest every day.
That's not a bad thing.
So that's what I was gonna ask you about is some people nationally have been comparing it to, I guess, the Tea Party, like whether it's a progressive, essentially a progressive Tea Party forming. And I want to know if you agree with the parallel, and also is that a positive? Could it be a positive?
I'm watching TV and I see Iowa. And I see Michigan, and I see Ohio. Those people are angry again.
Right, about healthcare.
About healthcare. And, you know, it's funny. Jimmy Kimmel. I'm watching TV one night, and they sent a guy on the street with a microphone to interview people about, do you support Obamacare or the ACA? Oh, Obamacare's bad. ACA's good. I mean, I don't even think they understand what ACA is. It is Obamacare. Yeah. But because Obama's name's on it, and I will tell you this, a lot of and what's sad and really disappointing to me at this particular time in my life and this country's life, race is still a driving factor in people's views. It is a driving factor. Obamacare is bad because Obama is the first black president of the United States. Mm-hmm. And Hillary wasn't going to get elected because it's a continuation of Obama and we want him. And we'd rather have Donald Trump. I mean, look, you might not like Hillary Clinton. You might not like her personality. But if you mean to tell me that he's better than her, that his picks for like Steve Bannon and Miller, not Steve Miller, guys, as frightening as a person I've ever seen in my whole life. It's like this.
He's like a robot.
He's a robot, and it's like this fascist view of the world that they are the president's decisions will not be challenged. Bullshit. They're going to be challenged. They're going to be challenged in court all over the country. Mm-hmm. They're being challenged. What? Mm-hmm. You didn't write the Constitution, dude. Mm-hmm. I mean, and to our...
A Trump reality is starting to have an economic consequence, which is, you know, these threats. You know, I had a conversation with a few people at Juntos down in South Philadelphia, mm-hmm. And they're concerned that if you know that you might bend if it gets.
Look, I can't defy a federal court.
Okay,
I won't defy a federal court. Unlike the president, who defies federal courts every day, and we'll try to figure out how to. My first reaction is to fight, mm-hmm. and I will continue to fight until we have no other legal remedy to fight with. And I'm hoping that we can drag this out till 2018 and maybe get one of the houses or both houses of Congress back mm-hmm. and get some sensibility. Mm-hmm. I mean,
but can the city afford to take a hit?
I can't afford a $500 million hit. No.
Okay.
I mean, we can't. Mm-hmm. But we'll try to figure out what we can do if we're forced to, not because we want to, if we're forced to keep people safe at the same time, accommodating the alt right.
Yeah.
Well, I think we'll wrap up. I just want to thank you again, Mayor, for coming on the podcast. Nice. And also, you've obviously, I think, impressed a lot of people who are fighting for social justice in your first year. So thanks.
It's just, you know yourself when something's wrong, mm-hmm. when people are being treated badly. I mean, I always tell kids in school, you're not a bully, I know. And the kids who are being bullied are a small group, and the kids who are bullying are a small group. And in the middle is this wide group of people. You know it's wrong. Mm. You can't stand by and let it happen. You have to, and I don't mean you have to beat the bully up. Sometimes that happens. The bullies always get beat up in the end. And they do.
Is that a call to action?
Bullies always get beat up in the end. But my point is that you don't have to beat up the bully to help somebody. Mm-hmm. You take that kid who's being bullied and you sit him at your lunch table. Mm. Or you make him part of your group. Mm-hmm. Or her part of your group. And then there's nothing worse, I think, than feeling so alone and isolated and unwanted and uncared for. And I think that's what we're responsible for doing as a city, is to make sure that we bring these kids in and we bring these neighborhoods in and make them feel like they matter, because they do.
So, Chris, we wanted to bring on someone who was probably smarter than us, who had studied this a little bit more than us, maybe in an academic setting. And so I stumbled across this book called Political Solidarity, mm-hmm. and it was written by a local professor from Villanova named Sally Schultz. And it's really, really interesting stuff. I mean, she gets into both the differences, I guess, the nuances of, solidarity versus unity, and also different types of solidarity, civic solidarity, which is almost kind of a form of patriotism or solidarity amongst people of a state. And then she gets into different forms and political solidarity be one of them. But anyways, in the book, it was written in 2008, and she just gets into so many issues that I feel like are hot button issues right now on the left, from, how do you incorporate people of the non-oppressed, people who are privileged, into a movement that's supposed to be, helping people who are oppressed. Right down the line. So I think it's going to be really, really interesting. And what did you make of, I guess, taking a snippet of reading some of her writing?
It was interesting. I think, the piece that I'm most interested in talking to her is in the literature I read, she argues that political solidarity and violence are incompatible. Mm-hmm. Not quite sure if I agree. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking to see if that's where she still is and why she feels that way and what's informing that view.
Thanks for coming on, Sally. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me.
So you've written a lot about political solidarity, or all forms of solidarity, I guess, within social movements. So one of the phrases I love from your book, and I was hoping you could tease it out a little bit for us, is this phrase called parasitical solidarity. And I guess my understanding is it's kind of a rhetorical form of solidarity. So maybe you could explain that to us. And also, I'm wondering, second question is, social media right now, a lot of people post things on Facebook and then don't show up to events. Is that a form of that type of parasitical solidarity?
Those are terrific questions. Thank you so much for asking them. The parasitical solidarity is the idea that someone uses the term to actually invoke certain of the moral content of solidarity without, in fact, making the full commitment to solidarity. And when I use this term, I actually had in mind certain uses of the term solidarity in response to natural disasters and in response to major terrorist attacks. There was a terrorist attack actually in Spain around the same time, and solidarity was in the news. And I was suspicious, actually. And I don't want to be the arbiter of all things solidarity, but I found that a number of people would use the term really as a stand-in for sympathy. And sympathy is important, and it's important when we are, especially in events of tragedy, we're reaching across borders and differences. But solidarity is different. Solidarity has a strong moral component that includes the commitment to act and to act with others. And I think when we use it simply as an expression of sympathy, then we're trying to act as if we are engaged and involved.
I think I share some of your suspicion, or at least recently after the election, because I don't know, at least online, I'm now off Facebook, but there were a lot of people, I think, who were making really strong comments. And I think, at least I was always suspicious that maybe some people wanted to, take the idea that they were a strong progressive or an ally, but maybe weren't, being active. So I guess I was wondering, what is authentic political solidarity? Like, what would that look like?
Well, could I actually address your social media
question
first?
Yes.
With social media plays a huge role and an important role in bringing people together and in raising awareness about issues. I don't think it's solidarity, however. I think it's part of activism. It's a form of activism, and it's a form of raising awareness. But posting something on Facebook is not being involved with a group or accepting the personal commitment and potential self-sacrifice that is involved with actually putting oneself on the line for a cause. And so I actually argue that there is no such thing as cyber solidarity. We can make connections with people through Facebook, but that's not a form of political solidarity in the way I use it.
If you can answer both of these at the same time about the political solidarity, and with political solidarity, is it inherently have to include action? Does action have to be germane to political solidarity? Because there, there's reports of, there was this the fist emoji has been used so many times on Twitter to represent solidarity, and there's also this hashtag activism. You don't consider any of that political solidarity if it's absent of activism. It's always parasitical.
Oh, well, so that's a great question. I generally think that people who are using the fist emoji are doing more than just using the emoji. So when I say there's no cyber solidarity, I'm saying, look, if you're just using that emoji, yeah, you're not part of the group. And because that's just too easy to do. I imagine that some might find that problematic. Imagine if someone were to say something in the privacy of their own home. If I were to make a political statement I believe in feminism in the privacy of my own home, I'm not having an impact on others. I'm not having an impact on my own life unless I make that further commitment. And I guess I view the emoji as comparable to that sort of private conversation, that soliloquy that one makes in their own home. There needs to be some active involvement with others for solidarity. And so if the emoji is just a sort of personal banner, then it's not engagement with others. The short answer, does solidarity require action, is, I think, yes.
So, Sally, one of the chapters in your book is called The Paradox of the Participation of the Privileged. And I wanted to know, and I won't go, I'd love to read a long passage, but I won't do that. But in that, you make some arguments, or at least kind of tease out some ideas that maybe, participation of people who are not part of the oppressed group, whether it's, social justice march and, talking about, say, white people, or, the women's march and including men, that there are advantages to including the non-oppressed in a political solidarity movement. Could you explain that a little bit? Why is that important, or what could be the advantages of that?
So thank you very much for the question. I do think that my thought has changed just a bit with this, but I do think that it is important that those who are actually privileged by forms of oppression participate in the solidarity to overcome or overthrow forms of oppression. And the thinking there is is in part that those of us who benefit from oppression and those of us who are privileged by it need to come to an awareness of our place in systems of oppression. We need to see how we benefit from it, and we need to then challenge those structures. We also need to perhaps throw off a lot of the privilege that comes with it. One of the examples that I had in mind when I was writing the passage about the paradox of the participation of the privileged was advocacy for the homeless. And there, the idea is that the privileged don't necessarily have to become homeless themselves in order to be advocates for the homeless, in order to know and fully understand the situation of homelessness. There's two issues. There's one is the advocacy issue, and then the other is the knowledge issue. In order to fully have knowledge of a situation, I do think it's important that there's those who experience the oppression are at the forefront of our attention and at the forefront of our learning. So we can gain quite a lot when we listen to one another and understand the experiences of homelessness, or understand, for to use your example, the experience of racial oppression. We have to go through, as whites have to go through the process of unlearning their racism and unlearning their own place of privilege in the racist structure.
So, Sally,
go ahead.
Please. Oh, sure. I wanted to jump on this, to see what other thoughts had changed since writing this book, particularly. In one of the articles you wrote, Political Solidarity and Violent Resistance, one of the pieces you wrote, you wrote some literature where you argued that political solidarity is incompatible with physical violence or physical forms of violence in activism. Do you still feel that way? And if so, what would you call the works of, say, the Black Panther Party or even the uprising in Baltimore and Ferguson, where there was destruction of property and there was bodily harm, but those protesters, those activists, those people felt as if they were acting in solidarity with the larger movement, the larger sentiment in this country.
Yeah, good. That's a terrific question and a terrific challenge to me and my thought, in fact. And I will say that I do still hold that political solidarity as a moral relation is structured by a logic of inclusion, and inclusion resist violence. I think I need to say that, and I think that's one way that I can also then draw out a conclusion that groups like the KKK are in fact not engaged in political solidarity. They have other forms of unity, and we can call it a form of activism. We can call it a lot of different things, and certainly it's also been called racial solidarity. On my account, solidarity as a moral relation is based in the logic of inclusion and is nonviolent as a result.
What informs that? If I could just ask as a quick follow, what informs that belief that you just espoused?
The logic of inclusion?
Yeah, that the moral relation and that violence, that inclusion can't have it with violence. Is that simply academic that you're getting that information from, or is that a more personal?
So a great question. Yes, on the one hand, it is a sort of logical argument from the logic of inclusion. On the other hand, though, I was in my writing in the article that you mentioned, I was inspired by the civil rights movement and Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement. And you recall, of course, that King espoused nonviolence. And King used a lot of very compelling arguments for nonviolence, one of which, of course, is that violence is a tool of the oppressors. And that is, I think, very compelling. The examples that you also mentioned, though, and King's movement also benefited from those outside of his particular group who, in fact, provoked police through violent acts. So violence plays a role in social reform and in revolutions of sort. But as the moral relation of solidarity, I think that we need to prioritize what solidarity means as a coming together for a cause. That coming together is out of our uniqueness and out of our diversity. We, I think, close that off when we employ.
So one of the things I was wondering is a lot of you often write about Rousseau, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, right? I have the right Rousseau in that, right?
Jean-Jacques Rousseau, yes.
Okay. you often invoke him, and you talked about how he very much thought a lot of the same ideas about solidarity. So I don't know if it's either looking to him or you know, just in your own I guess discovery process or thinking process. I wanted to ask that a lot of people, there seems like there's a protest every day, and I keep hearing that, you know, some people are, you know, will go to, you know, 5 protests a week, but they still feel some sense of, I guess, guilt when they don't go to one, and they feel like, you know, maybe they're not standing in solidarity by missing one march or one protest. And I guess I just wanted to know if you know, if you had any thoughts about that in terms of, you know, is there any quota for solidarity, or how does one, I guess, negotiate, you know, not standing in one moment, but still feeling like they're in solidarity?
Oh, that's, yeah, thanks. I think that's a very difficult issue, especially in these times. One of the things that I also, it's connected to that, is how do we maintain the group even in spite of our diverse commitments? Because people, of course, do come to solidaristic activities from a variety of different perspectives and viewpoints. I consider exigency, or the urgency of needs, to be one of the primary ways to measure participation in solidarity, and I think it's important both on the group level and then also on the individual level. There are those among us who have a wide array of commitments and moral obligations to others. We need to be considerate and think through those, as well as our commitments to political activism.
One of the most, I don't want to say surprising, I guess I'd say heartening things, Malcolm, that I've seen in the city is that now there is a organic movement between the Black community and the Latino community, the immigrant community, mm-hmm. Around this idea of criminalizing Black and brown bodies,
right,
and how to combat against it. Right. And our next guest, Reverend Gregory Holston of POWER, Philadelphians Organized to Witness, Empower, and Rebuild, and Erica El Maron from Juntos, recently have been working to push the mayor, who they're relatively happy with, but both of them feel as if Philadelphia is to be a Fourth Amendment city. There's certain things that have to happen that haven't yet happened.
Right, and he famously called, you know, or invoked and said that Philadelphia would be a Fourth Amendment city.
Well, not would be, but is.
It is.
Right. And so I applaud the mayor on his initiative to do so. I think him standing in solidarity with the immigrant community and ensuring that we're a sanctuary city is the right thing to do. But of course, things can always be better. Mm-hmm. And our next two guests have ideas about that, how to truly organize around this idea of the Fourth Amendment city and bring that to fruition. So mm-hmm. I'm excited about the conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. So we'll bring on Erica and the Reverend right now.
Okay, welcome to the show. As you know, we've been talking a lot about solidarity, and I thought that it was really interesting to hear about the link that brought you two together. Reverend Holston, you've been doing a lot of work in this city on Stop and Frisk and talking about the Fourth Amendment. And Erica, you've been doing a lot of work around immigration. And a lot of the stuff that you've talked about is we're not quite yet there in terms of being a Fourth Amendment city. So if you can, Erica, just start a little bit about how you guys got together in this moment. What was the call to action that was the kind of the catalyst for this moment of solidarity between you and Reverend Holston?
Right. Well, I think for us, the work at Juntos has always been immigrant rights focused for sure, but it's also about who is under attack. And so our work has been inside of schools also about the ways that young people have been criminalized. We talk a lot about the criminal injustice system, the school to prison pipeline. And so our parents and young people have been, I think, versed around the connections between criminal justice issues and immigration and how they're two sides of the same coin. And it just felt like a very important moment, I think, after this election, as we saw how much more we were all going to be criminalized and the need for our communities to be joining in this moment. And so much was happening around the defense of sanctuary cities, but we had always said that the city of Philadelphia was never essentially a sanctuary city because raids still happened, because police were still profiling black and brown folks, because school police were still inside of our schools. Mm. And so I think the call has been to work together to refocus the city on what is it that we're planning on doing in this time.
And Rev, you would agree that it's the criminalization of the black and brown body that, that caused you into this moment with Erica?
Absolutely. Just to go back a little bit, for me as an executive director of Power, Power had been a little bit involved in immigration, but not a lot. But our national organization, PICO Network, the PICO Network, has very much been involved in immigration work. And so when this moment happened with this new election, it was very clear when we met on a national level to really begin to really address actually President Obama before he left, demanding that all 11 million undocumented immigrants are be pardoned, and that also all federal prisoners who have nonviolent offenses be also pardoned or have their sentences commuted. That when we started to talk about that on a national level, it just naturally brought us to see the common links. Mm-hmm. When I'm hearing the stories of those who immigrants who have been had their families divided, or those particularly those DACA folk who have are so afraid of losing their parents or losing their brothers or sisters, it very much felt like my own story with many of my nephews, and particularly in my family, my wife's family is from Erie, Pennsylvania. So many of my nephews who I've seen for, been married for 30-some years, and I've seen them grow up to become young men, and almost all of them have gone off into this prison system, have been incarcerated. And the disconnection that we've had, the separation of our families, and I so much related to them just being fearful of losing their families because I've lost so many of my nephews in the similar way. Mm-hmm. And so it was really, when we started to talk about it, it was about how do we preserve family?
So
how we, and it was about how do people of color, because the attacks were on us, how do we preserve our families and keep our families together?
Mm-hmm. So the Fourth Amendment city was something, of course, that Mayor Kenney, was his statement. And I keep going back to the image at the airport when, thousands of people showed up, earlier in January, and you know Senator Bob Casey was there, Mayor Kenney was there, and so the topic of the show is about solidarity, and I think maybe people on the outside saw these politicians coming as an act of solidarity. At the same time, you've been somewhat critical, I guess, of the Fourth Amendment city. So I guess I wanted to know, like, do you consider the mayor standing in solidarity in this moment, I guess, with you? And also, is there room for dissent within solidarity? Can he both be standing and you can be critical of him?
Yes, that is exactly, I think, where we need to be right now. I think our community is very happy that Kenny has come out and said that he's going to defend community, that he's going to stand with this policy, that our ICE holds policy and our Fourth Amendment policy is important. And you can also push somebody at the same exact time. And I think that as a mayor, and in this moment, it's on all of us to say to him, we need more, and that we're thankful at the same time.
What would a Fourth Amendment city look like, Reverend? Let's start with you.
The Fourth Amendment of the United States talks about to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures. Mm-hmm. For immigrants who are coming to this country to be grabbed and pulled out of their homes, out of the arms of their loved ones in the middle of the night is an unreasonable search and seizure.
But is it unreasonable if let's say someone to push back and say, well, it's not unreasonable because undocumented immigrants aren't protected by the same constitutional rights as an American?
Well, I certainly understand that from a legal perspective, and I'm sure there's some legal arguments going back and forth on that. Here, this is a point where I would invoke my faith.
So it's a moral thing.
Oh, it certainly is. We are called to love our neighbors, and the context of the scripture that talks about that, the story of the Good Samaritan, does not say, "Oh, okay, let's make sure they have the documents first before we care for them, or make sure that they are only white people before you care for them, or make sure that they've come from your nationality or they're your religion before you care for them. If you call, as all Christian people are certainly called, and I would argue most faiths are called, to love our neighbor, those standards don't apply. We're supposed to reach out and love all of them.
So just getting back to it, what would a Fourth Amendment city look like?
I bring my faith, like many of our founders of our nation, the writers of our Constitution brought their faith to the writing of those particular declarations. So I would take into account that we have also put to the Constitution to talk about freedom of religion, that people should not be judged by their race or their national origin. These are fabrics of our nation. And so any policy, even if it regards to just immigrants, which singles out immigrants of color and does not single out immigrants from other nationalities, that's wrong. That's against our beliefs. That's against what I believe our Constitution says. And I believe we need to stand up for both what our faith and Constitution says.
I think the concept of Fourth Amendment, the city had been called for a while a sanctuary city. There was a lot of pushback on the word sanctuary. The right, it's a trigger word for the right. Mm. You call anything a sanctuary, they jump on it. Because in this moment, there also is a desire to scapegoat immigrants as a way to criminalize them also, and so that you can justify policies that could affect a lot of people. So I think it's being able to be aware of that. The Fourth Amendment, the reason it's called the Fourth Amendment is because what we were able to do was say that local police cannot hold somebody without a warrant signed by a judge, mm-hmm. right? And so that's why it's connected to the Fourth Amendment. Mm-hmm. Is that an accurate term for the policy? Yeah, we're saying you must abide by this amendment in the Constitution. Are there other ways that the city could do that better? Yes, I think with stop and frisk, we've talked about this as an issue, that mm-hmm. it's unreasonable searches and seizures. So you could talk about this in other ways where the police state has embedded our homes, has embedded our streets, and how do you roll back and talk about searches and seizures in that way?
I wanted to get your perspective as a longtime organizer. The moment at the airport that I referenced a few weeks ago, when thousands of people showed up to protest at the time, President Trump's ban on, what he's saying is not all Muslim immigrants, but essentially what it was. Was a moment, I guess, a turning point from a lot of people feeling pessimistic to feeling optimistic, I guess, about what a progressive coalition can do. But did that give you the same sense of hope, or do you also have to be, I guess, pragmatic and realize that sometimes organizing movements ebb and flow, that like the support can come and they can also dissipate?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think we're in an exciting moment. I don't think in all the years that I've done this work that we could get 5,000 people to an airport, you know, basically by a couple of tweets. And, you know, it's a different time. And I think that mobilizing is important. And I think bodies on the streets are important for people to be mobilizing. And then I think it's on leaders inside of the city to be shaping the policies and what we need the city to look like moving forward. I think we're seeing people that have never been mobilized on the streets. That's exciting to me. And I think a lot of people are asking questions of what to do. And I think this is the moment to take the lead from those who are most impacted by communities of color, Black, Latino, immigrant, Muslim, LGBTQ folks, women, right? And I think that those coalitions are going to be powerful. And I think there's room. I mm-hmm. think that there's room to do yes. effective work in this moment. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I'm excited about it.
This is unprecedented. Just to clarify, this is unprecedented solidarity that you've seen in terms of the length that you've been organized. You've never seen a moment like this.
I don't think I've seen people feel so intensely that they need to move together the yes. way that we have now.
Same for you, Rev?
Without a doubt. I mean, I was a child when the civil rights movement happened, so I don't really have reference points. I know there have been times like the movement against apartheid in South Africa and those who walked around the South African embassy and did many of those protests, that was kind of a unifying time, but nothing compared to this.
And so it seems like there's a protest almost every day, or, you know, almost an organic protest. And one of the things I think we've been trying to tease out in this discussion is about, we keep going back to movement versus moment, this idea of how do you sustain and have longevity with this movement. And I guess I wanted to know also, I mean, do you have any concerns that so many people are coming out, I guess, to protest or to go against Trump, that I guess there's a villain almost in the situation? And is that important to sustaining longevity, or could that be a crutch to sustaining longevity? How do you feel about how so many people, I guess, are targeted their energies just at Trump?
Mm-hmm. I think people should target their energy at Trump. He's a Nazi. I think people should be calling him that by now, fascist. And he is dangerous, as we've seen. And the administration that he's building right now is dangerous, especially for people who look like everybody in this room, right? And I think that movement, as opposed to mobilizing is what we're seeing. Mm. Movement is the development of leadership. Mm. Movement is our responsibility to build leaders in this moment. And I think, you know, I've spent the last several years building leadership in the city of young people, of young black and brown people, and I'm seeing them step up in this moment and developing and like using all the skills that they've developed. And I think that it's on us, like this is a moment to develop more leaders who are ready to be in the front lines with us.
So in this moment, how can people stand in solidarity with you guys, starting with you, Erica? People want to reach out to Juntos. What's the work that you're doing and how people can stand in solidarity with you?
We need volunteers right now. So if people are interested in volunteering, please call the office 215-218-9079. We are looking to launch a human rights zone in South Philadelphia, training a lot of our members and a lot of our neighbors on what to do if police or ICE show up in your house, and then what to do if police or ICE are harassing people on the streets, and what are your rights, how to record, how to document. They'll be surveilling us. We need to be surveilling them.
And at Power, Philadelphia is organized to witness, empower, rebuild. Powerinterfaith.org is our website. We are working on a variety of issues from economic justice, raising the minimum wage, fair funding for our schools, to end stop and frisk, to no cash bail, a variety of issues we work on. And we also support our strong federal and state response teams to respond to all of these issues that are coming down the pike. We're going to be on the front line to make sure that those issues get addressed and that we win on all those issues eventually. If you want to join us and be a part of us, please go to powerinterfaith.org, hit the donate button, and you can see how you can volunteer or give to Power. Mm-hmm. The more independent money we have, the more independence we can have to continue to do this great work.
Thank you both so much for joining us. We really, really do appreciate it.
No, thanks for having us.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
All right.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this conversation on the topic of solidarity. There will be many more episodes like this to come. Please subscribe on iTunes, and you can find podcasts like this on 900amwurd.com. And so, Malcolm, how can people keep up with you until the next episode?
It would be at Malcolm Burnley on Twitter would probably be the best way.
Okay. And I'm also on Twitter at Flood the Drummer. And again, we want to thank you guys for being tuned in to Pushback. Until next time, I'm Flood the Drummer, and I'm drumming for justice.